I think meetings have gotten a bit of a bad rap. Like, the reason we collaborate is because all of our brains are more powerful than one of our brains. So if we're choosing fewer meetings, we're also choosing less collaboration time, which I think means leveraging fewer brains. So all that to say is, I don't know if we need fewer meetings. I agree that we need better meetings. If the whole meeting is one person presenting and then saying, send me questions in Slack, no. Record your presentation, let them watch it in their own time. Use the synchronous time to co-process, to leverage all of those brains.
Hi, I'm Bob Mathers, and welcome to The Growth Mixtape, a podcast where I talk to the most interesting people you might not have come across yet. I find that these conversations give me new insights and perspectives about topics I didn't know existed. These conversations might not seem to have a lot in common at first, but just like songs and a mixtape, they create something memorable and emotional. Today we talk to Carrie O'Brien. Carrie is an expert in how people learn. He's also a podcaster and public speaker devoted to helping people build new skills and strong teams. We talk about the misconceptions around Gen X, Gen Z, and millennials, and how that the one thing that never changes is the science behind how people learn. We also talk about virtual teams, and that the number one thing most of them are missing? Trust. Finally, we talk about fear of failure. And this is a big one for me. We share embarrassing fails from our early childhood, how these held us back for years, and how nobody gives a shit but us. There are also some Easter eggs for any of you Radiohead or Weezer fans out there. This episode's got it all. So please enjoy Carrie O'Brien. Welcome, Carrie O'Brien, to the podcast. I'm really looking forward to this conversation. Thanks for coming.
Oh, it's my absolute pleasure, Bob. Thank you.
So here's the interesting thing, Carrie. I wanted to provide a little context for this conversation. We're going to talk about learning development. You've got some really interesting things to say about, you know, hybrid work and collaboration and how adults learn and how much that's changed over the years. It's interesting because my experience, I guess, with quote unquote learning and development hasn't always been awesome over the span of my career.
Mine too, to be fair.
Yeah, right. So I was thinking back about, and when I say learning development, I basically mean like how my employer taught me new things. And I remember, I'm really dating myself now, Office 95, I think it was Office 95 came out. And I was in a classroom. They sent us offsite to a classroom for 5 days, a day on Outlook, a day on Word, a day on Excel, et cetera. 40 hours of training in a classroom. And my outlook on that was that, okay, I'm going to spend 40 hours here. And if I can leave and take away three things that I can apply in my life on Monday, I consider that to be a good use of my time. Like, think about that. That's how low the bar was. 40 hours of my time, including traveling back and forth and eating, you know, catered lunches. And all I expected was three things. I'm just wondering how that experience kind of resonates with you, or if you recognize any of your early experiences in there somewhere.
100%. Like, I didn't start doing learning and development until well after Windows 95, Bob. But what you're describing resonates. And I think too, what it's reflective of is some of the limitations of the craft back then. You know, we didn't have a lot of opportunity for, say, personalized learning. We didn't have a lot of opportunity or modalities or technology that enabled us to access people on an individual level. So a lot of what we did back then was what you would call, in the business, we call it spray and pray, which is you spray as much content at your learners as you can, and you pray that some of it sticks. You know, today, when you think about what we have access to today, and AI is going even deeper with this, and that's a whole other conversation. But what L&D is able to do today is personalize learning a lot more. Part of that is because a lot of us are working remotely. We're doing learning asynchronously, and asynchronous learning is also much better than it used to be before. And so we have the luxury, for example, of doing this. Way back in the day, this was called flipped classroom, where instead of showing up with a bunch of people in person to hear a lecture to get information transfer, and then going home and doing readings related to that, you would do all of the information transfer asynchronously. And so the leading edge of this in, say, higher education was I had profs who would give us CDs of their lecture and be like, listen to this. This is your homework. And then when we come together, we're actually going to talk about it. We're going to co-process it. Now you can take all of those knowledge transfer processes, you can put them in a super engaging e-learning course, and then you can save that synchronous time, hopefully not 40 hours on the Microsoft suite, but that synchronous time for co-processing. What is important to you here? Why is that important? What doesn't feel good? Why doesn't it? Get into a small group. Let's talk about this. So a great example of this is Difficult Conversations. There has been a version of a Difficult Conversations leadership module in just about every leadership development program since 1972. Like it is just like it's a core competency. If you don't know anything of what leaders need to know, Difficult Conversations and Strategic Decision Making, those are the two things they need. So in a traditional, less technological setup, you would have to spend so much time just doing knowledge transfer of like, here are the frameworks. Here's how you recognize. Here's how you interact without ever getting to the point of actually practicing. Now you can do all that knowledge transfer beforehand. And if you want, you can spend the entire time synchronously just practicing these concepts in a safe to fail environment with other learners before you get to the point of having to actually use it. It's fantastic.
Yeah, that's amazing. I was listening to you talk too, I was thinking about on more of a micro level and the daily things that we spend most of our time on in terms of meetings. So how do you take those things and apply them to a meeting? Because we've all been in a situation where we're in a 2-hour meeting and it's just information being fired at us. And we'd like to think, you were talking about how things have changed. It doesn't always feel like things have really changed that much. We're all in a lot of meetings like that. Whereas like, wouldn't it been better if we could have sort of absorbed and reflected on this information on our own time and then come together to use this time to discuss and collaborate on it? Does that apply to those meetings as well, you think, or how does it?
100%. I think meetings have gotten a bit of a bad rap. You hear this a lot. It's like, if I had less meetings, I could get more work done. And okay, that might be true, but you're also like, the reason we collaborate is because all of our brains are more powerful than one of our brains. So if we're choosing fewer meetings, we're also choosing less collaboration time, which I think means leveraging fewer brains. So all that to say is, I don't know if we need fewer meetings. I agree that we need better meetings. And that principle I talked about, that flipped classroom principle of a meeting, synchronous time together, should not be about information transfer. If the whole meeting is one person presenting and then saying, send me questions in Slack, no.
Right.
Record your presentation, let them watch it in their own time. Use the synchronous time to co-process, to leverage all of those brains. So the two tips I give for really effective meetings, one, make sure every meeting has a purpose. And make sure that purpose is an information transfer. So every meeting invitation I send, I use this little phrase. I say, after this meeting, after this session, whatever it is, we will leave with a better understanding of X, more context on Y, the decision, whatever on this, like just whatever we're doing the meeting for. And if I look at that and I'm like, oh, I could do that all asynchronous. Oh, yeah, don't have the meeting. The second thing we need is an understanding of who the decision maker is. Especially in very polite Canadian companies, which we've all been a part of, we have trouble actually saying, okay, all opinions heard, here's what the decision is. And so if your meeting is related to a decision, make sure that you actually know who the decision maker is. And then that way you can say, all opinions heard, this is a decision, everyone can disagree and commit, and we can move on. That's a little aside from the learning and development side. That's just what I've seen of after 14 years of being in some ineffectual meetings. But that flipped classroom piece also applies, where if you don't have a clear purpose that has to be accomplished synchronously, you probably don't need the meeting.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I'm definitely going to take those away as things that I will endeavor to do, because I will admit I've heard things like that before about better meetings, et cetera. I see inside of a lot of different companies, and I don't see very many having the discipline to do that. I can tell you, when you do it, you really stand out. Like, people are so used to shitty meetings that it's like, wow, you get an invite from Carrie. I know exactly what I'm in for. I know what I'm supposed to bring. I know I'm going to leave that going, yep, that was a good meeting.
Well, this is it. And I mean, there's lots of reasons we don't do it. For one thing, I mean, I think people get afraid of being trapped. When you say what you're for, when you say what a meeting is for, you also say what it's not. I will not call that like a silver bullet to say, as long as you have a purpose and as long as you know who the decision maker is, you will never have a bad meeting again. But I think they give you the best chance to have a good meeting.
You know, as you were talking about that too, I was reflecting, and we all have, okay, well, I guess the next step is to have another meeting. No, you've got to do your homework and think through what those issues are. And that's just more work. And that's just not something a lot of people are used to.
No, exactly.
So I was thinking about virtual teams. I talked to lots of different leaders, and I swear I have this conversation a couple of times a week. We're hiring somebody new. Do they need to be here? Do they need to be there? Can they be 100% virtual? And I know you've got a perspective on this, and I'd love to hear what you've seen and how you think companies need to find that balance for themselves.
Sure. Bob's out here trying to get me in trouble. So virtual teams, I approach virtual teams purely from a learning and development perspective. So I'll preface this by saying I don't have a holistic view that, say, like a CEO would have. I purely look at it from like, well, how do people learn well together? How do people interact well together? I have done some research on this because the shift to a hybrid leaning towards virtual, you know, workplace, which is a lot of places these days, certainly all the places that I operate in, has really changed the way I do learning. When you talk about that synchronous time together, it generally gives more energy, creates more energy to be in a room physically present with each other than it does to be behind a screen. The way even we're recording this podcast, as great as I'm sure it sounds, would sound entirely different if you and I were like face to face over a table rapping with microphones in our hands. Like it would just would. So recognizing that, and then recognizing that you kind of have to make the best of every situation you're in. So we're talking about your Microsoft training on Windows 95. That was less a function of like, this is the best possible learning and this is the best possible learning today. So I remember what virtual learning used to look like when I started. I remember doing product training for a group. I got into like a tiny little phone booth. I emailed a PowerPoint presentation to somebody. They all got in a conference room. They put that PowerPoint presentation on the screen. They dialed me in on one of those conference phones, you know, the ones that have like the dial pad with like the four legs on it and the speaker in the middle. And I spoke to the slides while someone in the room advanced them. And I would be like, next slide, please. That's what that looked like then. Now, of course, we have things like Zoom. We have things like Miro. What's different now is we also have that ability to take that knowledge transfer and do it asynchronously and leave that co-processing for synchronous learning. We can prioritize that. All that to say is virtual teams require a ton of trust and conscious investment in that trust. So in looking at the research, and there's been a lot of research, one good thing that came out of COVID is we got a real crash course in how virtual teams work together and a ton of data for researchers to parse. And the number one thing that virtual teams need to operate well is trust. That's not to say that in-person teams don't need trust, but it's actually way more important with virtual teams because they don't have the same opportunities, those micro opportunities to build trust by observing each other's work, observing each other in person, all those kinds of things. And so if we're going to operate in a virtual space, we need to create opportunities for teams to build trust with each other. And that can look like a few different things, but it requires us to be more conscious and intentional than it does in person. For example, generally you build trust with someone by watching them do a thing well. We see that they're competent. We see that they're well-meaning. So we can't do that as well virtually because we're all working in our little, you know, we're working at our home desks or whatever. One thing I've started doing is called deep work sessions, where I will invite a bunch of people to a Zoom room. The first 5 minutes, we'll all name a deep work task we want to get completed. I want to organize my Google Drive is a low-level version of that. I want to organize my thoughts around this product training thing I'm building. I want to write this facilitator guide, whatever it is. We spend the next 50 minutes doing that deep work thing, not talking. We're all on the Zoom. We're seeing how each other works. If questions come up, we ask, but we just keep working. We're observing each other working. And then the last 5 minutes, we talk about what we accomplished and we give ourselves ups. We observe each other being deep in the thing, building trust, and we create well-meaning exchanges with each other that build up our self-esteem and our connection with our coworkers. That's just one example. I'm not saying we need to recreate every aspect of the office. I think we all know what that, like, oh, that forced water cooler Zoom we'll do every week. Like, that doesn't feel good all the time. But being intentional about choosing certain in-person experiences to replicate virtually in a way that makes sense, I think can go a long way towards building that trust.
Yeah, I've never heard of that. I remember sitting around, you know, the high school cafeteria when everybody's trying to get their homework done, or, you know, being in cubicles. Like, that's really interesting. I hadn't thought of that. And that seems like a fairly low friction, easy thing to try out for most leaders.
And the sort of like low key, really helpful part of it, Bob, is for me, that's also time blocking. Mm-hmm. That is time that I know I'm going to work on that thing. I'm not going to be caught up in my email. I'm not going to be caught up in my Slack. I'm not going to be messing around on Amazon trying to find the perfect charger for my phone, which is a thing I do, I guess. I don't know. But no, I'm going to be actually doing the deep work. And so there's also a personal benefit there of like having that accountability.
Yeah. I love that. So I also wanted to ask you, it's interesting about generational differences, because I think we use it too often as a bit of a crutch and say, well, you know, millennials, they're different from us in these ways and they don't learn this way and we have to accommodate them this way. And sure, I don't think there's any denying that a generation of people that grew up with a computer in their hand with access to everything at their fingertips grew up learning very differently than I did. But how do you see those differences? I guess you can call them generational or age differences. I do think there are people in my generation that learn very differently. So it seems like a lazy explanation to base it only on age. But I'm wondering how you see that in practice in companies and how you need to accommodate different learning styles.
All right. Can we play a little game, Bob?
Okay.
I'm going to give you a quote. I want you to tell me what year you think it's from. You ready?
Yeah, I'm ready.
All right. The children now love luxury. They have bad manners, contempt for authority. They show disrespect for elders and love talking in place of exercise. Children are tyrants, not the servants of their household. What year do you think that was?
I'm going to say like 1967.
Try 469 BC. That was our man Socrates. The reason I give you that quote and I play that game with you, Bob, this is not new.
Yeah. Right.
My generation. So I was born December of 79. So I'm like Gen X with like just a hint of millennial. My generation was saying about the millennials. The millennials are saying about Gen Z. Gen Z will say, what's next? Gen Alpha, I think, is next.
Yeah, I lost.
I lost it. Who can keep track? The point is, there is always a disconnect between the way one generation interacts and the other. What's consistent is how humans learn. And so that's the place you have to start, is how do humans learn? Generally speaking, when we're trying to promote learning, there are three big categories. And for my learning heads, this is an oversimplification of Bloom's taxonomy. But we want to transfer knowledge, we want to build skills, and we want to change behaviors. That is generally the three things we want to do with learning. And so the way we do that might change a little bit from generation to generation. But that's less going to be because this generation is super different or whatever, and more, I think, because the technology, the culture, all of those things give us more options in how to do that. I think if you were to go back in time with the internet and build out learning for Gen Xers when we were just starting in the workforce, it would probably look very similar to what we're building today if we had the ability to front load that knowledge transfer and save the synchronous time for co-processing. Yeah, I try not to get too caught up in that generational thing, because you can even, because when you paint with a broad brush too, it becomes difficult. I have worked with millennials who grew up like deep urban, who are super online, who, you know, they love memes and all those kinds of things. I've also worked with millennials who grew up deep rural, and they're just not internet fluent in the same way. So I think when you try and paint things by generations, I think there can be some stuff there. There can be some like currency of culture there, but a culture today is especially so fragmented that more often than not, I think you're excluding rather than including. So I personally think having really good learning practices and taking full advantage of the tools you have and understanding how humans learn is more important than that generational currency.
I'm going to have to soak on that a bit, Gary, because that's really important. And I think in the context of some of my work, we always get into, well, who is the audience? And we're making all kinds of assumptions about how they might want to learn. I'm just not sure how helpful that is.
Can I give you a super hot take?
Hit me.
When you are deciding on modality, the learner barely matters.
Say more about that.
So there's this thing called learning styles. Have you ever heard of learning styles, Bob?
Yep.
Okay. Full disclosure, by the way, I have my BEd in adult learning. I am not like a super academic on these subjects. A lot of learned experience, you know, so I'm always open to be challenged and questioned. But learning styles are generally derided. It's the idea that like, well, I'm a visual learner, so I can only learn by reading. I'm an auditory learner, so I can only learn by somebody explaining it to me. And the way I often discredit learning styles is I say, like, Bob, if you, let's say you had a heart problem, you went to a heart doctor and you had to have a really tricky bypass surgery, sorry to say. And you said to the doctor, how many times have you performed this surgery? And the doctor said, well, I'm actually a visual learner, so I've watched someone do it a few times. And so I'm good to go. How comfortable on a scale of one, not at all comfortable, to 10, very comfortable, would you be with that doctor performing your surgery?
Yeah, it's like a 3.
Exactly. And the reason for that is we understand that we want for a very tricky, intricate process, a very specific deployment of skill and knowledge, we want someone to have had reps in a safe to fail environment before they do it for real. So when we're talking about the modality, how someone is going to learn a particular piece of knowledge, a particular skill, change a particular behavior, we want to think about the modality as an extension of that versus an extension of the learner's preferences. Now, that's not to say that there's not room to do a little bit of both. For example, if you're doing something that's pure knowledge transfer, you need to learn, let's say, actually a great example is the order of the planets. My partner is a visual learner. So when she learned the order of the planets, she like just sat down and read it over and over until she got it. I wrote a song about the order of the planets, which I am not going to sing for you here.
Come on.
Not going to happen. So that same information can be transmitted two different ways. But for a skill, it's really important, even if you're not an experiential learner, and if you can't see me, I'm doing the air quotes, that you get reps. Because that's the only way you skill build. So all that to say is, when you're considering a learning modality, consider your learning objectives first, consider what success looks like, and if you do expect to have a variety of learner preferences, not styles, but preferences in the mix, once you've got that key modality, those key objectives in place, if there are different ways you can do it, explore it, but that's secondary to making sure that the modality supports the objective. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It's just funny. I was having this conversation a couple of times over the last week, so it's a bit of recency bias, but, you know, providing updates, for example, to leadership teams. And I'm a big fan lately of doing video updates, which I get some good feedback on, but some people are like, yeah, but I'm on the train, or I'm like, I just needed to read it. I'm like, so I need to write it, which the reason that I wanted to do the video was to avoid writing it. So now I'm thinking about, well, is the best way to actually provide us, you know, right? A succinct text version, a video version. That's probably the right answer to give people the choice of how they prefer to consume content.
And as long as you think what you're trying to transmit goes that way. Like there's a reason we're doing this as a podcast and not as like a transcript, a text exchange, right? You can't hear my emotion. You can't hear if I have an accent, which changes the way you interact with the content. So this is the right medium for us to have this conversation. And you're not going to be like, oh, I'm going to give somebody a transcript of the pod I did with Carrie, because it's not going to translate the same way. So that would be one thing to consider. Now, if you consider it and you make that decision that yes, a transcript will have the same impact I want it to have as doing the video at the end of the day, that's perfect. That's great. But let's not assume that two separate media are the same. They're not. They change things. And we always need to keep our eye on what we're trying to achieve, whether it's communication or learning.
Yeah, I love that. Okay, so I wanted to ask you about your podcast. So the truth is that we probably wouldn't be having this conversation if it wasn't for your podcast.
Sure.
We had worked together, like you said, I don't know, 10 plus years or so ago. We kept in
LinkedIn touch.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. But it probably wouldn't have led to this conversation if it wasn't for this podcast. So you launched this podcast. And I'm like, damn, that's like super interesting. And I want you to explain a little bit about what it is. But it was interesting to me at the time because of all the new things that I find. I don't think I would always consider myself to be a lifelong learner, but I would say over the last 2 or 3 years, I'm trying things that I never would have tried before. And that's what really spoke to me about the podcast. So tell me a little bit about that.
Aw, that's rad. I'm super glad it spoke to you. So the podcast is called How'd You Learn To? The germ of the idea came where I realized I just had a lot of friends who had achieved mastery in these really interesting categories. And as a learning professional, I'm always just curious, is like, how do you achieve mastery at all? Like that's my whole job, right? And I had been kicking around ideas to start a podcast, and it was always like, well, do I do a professional podcast? Because I love learning and I love talking about that stuff, but that just might get kind of dry. I'm like, do I do a personal podcast? But like, what's the point? Like, I'm going to be the 500th like music podcast,
yeah,
in Kitchener where I live, you know, like what's the point of that? And so when I had this idea, I was like, okay, this is something I would post on Instagram and LinkedIn. Like my friends would be interested in on it because it's like really interesting processes, but my network would be interested in it because it like leverages learning theory and like how do people get there. And so I was really lucky enough to talk to a friend of mine about it, Lauren Raham, who I worked with at Shopify, and she was on board. So she came on board to co-host and produce, and we just identified 10 friends who had really interesting skill sets. So we had a certified tea sommelier, we had a professional magician, we had a networker, which is really interesting because there's no designation for it. But if you know this person, Toby, you know he's a master networker. And we talked to them about how they achieved mastery, what were the bumps in the road, and then processing that, because Lauren's in learning and development as well, processing that through our own understanding of learning theory and what those oftentimes born out of passion, what that can teach us about how we learn and how we can enable others to learn. So that's the short strokes of the podcast. But you can find it, by the way, if you're listening, at hiltpod.com, hiltpod.com. And we're on Spotify and Apple Music and Google and all that.
Yeah, one of the things that I really enjoy about podcasts like that, I was listening to the one you mentioned, the magic.
Yes.
And
Adam Ole.
Yeah, one of the things he was talking about was just this one phrase that stuck with me, how little people are actually paying attention as much attention to us as we think.
That was so humbling when you said that. I was like, it's so true. And I've never thought of it before.
Absolutely. And but what I mean, obviously in the context of doing sleight of hand or, you know, different illusions, but it sometimes we find these little tidbits that apply to different parts of our lives and we make those connections, which I think is the most interesting part of conversations like that.
The pessimistic way to say that, Bob, I think, is nobody cares as much about you as you do. Yeah. And I think in terms, specifically in terms of learning, what that really opened up for me, I think without being too reductive, I would say probably one of the biggest impediments to learning is fear of failure. An example recently, so we're a basketball family. My dad was a university basketball coach. I love basketball. And I'm coaching my son's basketball team, my 9-year-old, for the first time. So he's playing organized basketball for the first time. And the first few games were kind of funny because he would, like on offense, he would just like migrate out to the 3-point line. And I mean, I'm 6'4". He's big for his age. So like he should be down there banging bodies and grabbing rebounds, right? And so I'd say to him, hey, buddy, like, why aren't you getting down there? He's like, what if somebody bumps into me and I fall down? I was like, oh, are you afraid of getting hurt? He's like, no, I'm afraid of being embarrassed because I fell down. And that just like, it just came back to me. And this was after we had done this podcast. I was like, buddy, nobody's going to pay attention if you fall down. You know what? They are going to pay attention if you grab the rebound and start and put it back in the hoop. That's what's going to get people's attention. Everybody cares when you're doing something positive. Nobody's worrying about you falling down. That's totally understandable. Fast forward. And now he is just like, not only is he grabbing those rebounds, but he's like driving into traffic and doing all this stuff. And it just really proved how powerful it is to unlock that fear of like, I'm not being watched. Nobody is caring about like what practice I'm doing, what it looks like now. They're going to care further on. And we saw that too, like even with the podcast, like if you listen, we did them more or less in order and you can hear like the difference from podcast 1 to podcast 10 is pretty significant, but I don't have anybody reaching out being like, whoa, podcast 1 was garbage, homie. I'm sure glad you fixed that. Everyone's just like, yeah, these are all great. And I mean, that voice in our head is, it serves a purpose. It's there to protect us, right? We no longer get chased by saber-toothed tigers. And so we find threats in other places. But if we can look at that part of ourselves and say, hey, I get that you're trying to help me. I really appreciate it. I know what I'm doing. I'm in charge. If you just stand to the side and watch as I do this, I bet you'll see this is not as big a threat as you think it is. And we can achieve some amazing things when we do that.
Yeah. And I got that out of listening to a conversation about some dude I've never met learning magic. Like that's what, you know, it's amazing.
You should connect with Adam because he is a super good dude. He's such a great follow.
I was thinking about that. I've been reflecting on this a little bit, just a quick little story, because I've, just like most people, I've got my healthy share of fears of putting myself out there, et cetera. And I do think a lot of these go back to childhood. And I was thinking back, I think it was grade 4 or 5 when I was a stand-in for a Christmas play. And then the day before the Christmas play was to go on, the lead got sick. And so I was up and I got up there. And of course I forgot my lines and I was terrified. And I remember Tracy Ryan, she was like, actually went on to be an actress. And she had to whisper my lines to me. And I was crying afterwards. And I heard kids saying, you know, overheard them saying I ruined everything, et cetera. And a really traumatic thing. Now, of course, I guarantee I am the only one in that gymnasium that day that remembers that.
You haven't followed up with Tracy Ryan on that?
No, but hey, Tracy, if you're listening, reach out. I had a massive crush on her too.
Let me know.
But yeah, it was a total nightmare, like an adolescent nightmare, right? Yeah. But I was thinking, yeah, but I had the courage to put my hand up and be the stand-in. And I swear that was one of those pivotal kind of moments that I've sort of carried around that has led me to, you know, be a little bit averse to trying new things, at least on the public stage. So
slight sidebar. I want to, it's not a pet peeve, but it dumbfounds me the amount of people who say like, oh, you're just naturally such a great speaker. I'm like, I am not naturally a great anything. I have like my desire for attention might have led me to the stage, but like same as you, the first time I played drums, like the first time one of my bands like played a show, the drum kit collapsed on our first song. Like, it was the worst.
Not in a cool way. Like, not in a Dave Grohl Nirvana way.
No, no, no. Like, the snare, we were playing Wipeout because of course we were. So I had to do the whole song. Anyways, it's a whole other thing. But the point being is, like, I've had my share of, like, mess ups, trip ups, just, cringe moments. And all of those go into building me up better. Like, next time I will. But I can also be confident in the fact that I'm the only person who really remembers that. And just to give a teaser for the story you're talking about, so how'd you learn to be a magician? Adam tells a story about going on national TV and messing up a trick and nobody remembering. So if that can happen, you know, Bob as Joseph or Carrie drumming for the first time, like those are just stepping stones on the way to something greater. And yeah, it's a big part of learning how to learn.
Yeah, for sure. That's amazing. So one last thing about the podcast, I'm wondering, was there something that you've tried to do recently that sort of connected you with this idea? Have you got a couple of things that you've been trying?
So I've been in a refining old skills kind of situation right now because I just started a new job back a couple months ago. So it's really digging into that practice and not doing a ton new. But one thing that did happen at the company I'm with now, Clio, they have something called the Clio Band. And every year for our kickoff, they like virtually record a song together. So there's a drummer, there's, you know, bass player, guitarist, keyboardist, you know, whatever. And very close to the time where we had to have things done, our bass player was unable to record. They were moving house and it wasn't going to work for them. And I was the only other person who owned a bass guitar. Not that I'm good at playing a bass guitar. I owned a bass guitar. So I was like, I'll try it. Sure, we can give this a shot. So and the song was Don't Stop Believing, which does have a very ambitious bass line. So the first thing I did was sit down and try and learn it. And I quickly realized I couldn't play the whole thing. And there was a feeling of defeat there, right? Like, I can't do this. They need me to do this and I can't do this. It's going to be a failure. And then one of my former mentors had a saying, what does good enough look like? Not perfection. What does good enough look like? And I was like, well, I can do this run. I can't do that run. So if I do the chorus this way, but keep the verse the same, I can probably do this. And you probably know where this story is going. I recorded the good enough version. Nobody said a thing. In fact, everyone was like, wow, it's amazing. You can play both bass and guitar. You're really good at both. Meanwhile, in my heart, I'm like, I didn't play the full version and all that kind of stuff. And so I would say that, like, also knowing when you're learning something new, what good enough looks like is incredibly important to keeping yourself motivated and setting realistic expectations for yourself.
What does good enough look like? Yeah, I love that. That's awesome. Yeah, bass is definitely, it's a bit of a different animal. Like, I mean, that song that you played, everybody knows every sound, every, you know, drum fill, every vocal inflection in that song, right? It's so iconic.
Exactly.
So if there's ever a song that you would think that people would notice that something was different about the bass line, but still nobody does.
No. Sorry, bass players.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure there were a couple of bass nerds in the audience that were like, oh, yeah, what's he doing here? This isn't right. But
I did have one guy go like, why did you play with a pick? I'm like, because I can't play with my fingers. He's like, oh, okay. It sounded great. I was like, great.
That's awesome. This has been so much fun, Carrie. I did want to ask you a closing question.
Okay.
I want to share with you my track 8 philosophy. So track 8, you know, for younger listeners that, you know, that aren't as familiar with how we used to listen to music, I used to get my paycheck from Kentucky Fried Chicken, KFC, and go to the record store and buy my records, the Smiths or U2 or whatever, and come home, and the artists would agonize over the order of these songs, right? There were 5 on one side and 7 on the other, whatever. And that was the order you listened to them in. You didn't have shuffle. You didn't have any way of listening to them any other way. And when you listen to these albums, there would always be a couple of songs. You'd be like, oh yeah, that's really catchy. I really love that. And then there'd be usually other ones that I really didn't get or really didn't like. And oftentimes they were sort of buried at track 7 or 8. But after 5 listens, 10 listens, those ones that I liked right away became boring. And the tracks 7 and 8s became the ones that I really loved, those deep cuts that were my favorites and still are to this day. And I think, and I found that that applies to people, it applies to movies, it applies to all kinds of things in my life. The things that I immediately am attracted to, I get bored of. But the things that, I don't know, I mean, that dude was kind of abrasive and he was a bit of an ass and I didn't really like him, they really grow on me. And they become the people or the things that I'm closest to over time. So that was a bit of a rambling explanation of my track 8. And I'm wondering whether you've got any track 8s in your life.
Okay, so full disclosure, I like put this theory to the test while you were speaking. As soon as you like with the track 8s, I'm like, okay, my 2 favorite albums are The Blue Album by Weezer and OK Computer by Radiohead. And track 8 for The Blue Album is In the Garage, one of my all-time Weezer jams. Track 8 for OK Computer is Electioneering, one of my all-time Radiohead jams. And definitely neither of those would make, like, if you just asked a random person off the street, name 5 Weezer songs or name 5 Radiohead songs, neither of those would show up. So the theory holds. The theory holds, Bob. There's a lot of things I've matured into, and I think it's really a function of knowing yourself, like really, really taking the work to know yourself in all your glory and less glory. Like, I was a punk rock drama kid growing up, so I liked being in musicals, but I also like played shows on the weekends. And so one thing I always thought I wanted to surround myself was like really loud, bright, exciting people. And I've recognized that even as somebody who can be loud, bright, and exciting, or excited, I guess I should say, the best conversations I've had have been with like more quiet and thoughtful people. And so I would say space, quiet, and pauses are something I never thought I would like in my life. And it's something I really appreciate now, both on a big level in terms of like my Saturday morning routine, where it's like, it's quiet for like 2 hours. It's great. And both on a personal level where you don't have to fill every space in a conversation and providing time to think, consider, and respond often creates a better conversation. So at the risk of sounding very like old and mellow, I will say space and quiet are something I never thought I would appreciate in my life. And now I appreciate deeply in my life.
See what I did just there? Giving you a little bit of space.
I do. No, I marinated in it. I luxuriated in it.
No, I absolutely, God, I can't. You're absolutely right. And that's definitely the best answer to that track 8 question that I've ever had. That really resonates with me as I guess at some point as we get older, we start to spend a little bit more time trying to figure ourselves out and understanding ourselves. I love that answer.
Yeah, the only constant in your life is going to be you.
Right.
Everything else is subject to change.
Well, Carrie, I can't thank you enough for agreeing to come on. This has been, you know, just been a really fun and engaging conversation. I already made note of 3 or 4 threads that I'm going to pull on and take back to my real life as a revenue coach and working with tech companies. So this has been awesome. Thank you so much for doing this. I really owe you one. This has been awesome.
My pleasure entirely. Have a good one.
The Growth Mixtape Podcast with Bob Mathers is produced by Bespoke Projects. Music by Jean-Michel Walter Cronkite. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to follow and rate us. When you do this, it helps to raise our podcast profile so that more people can find us. If you want to connect, you can find me on LinkedIn using the link in the show notes.